Good evening, everybody. Before we start the main event of the evening, as usual, is an announcement about forthcoming events. We have one lecture left before Christmas, which is taking place on Tuesday, the 8th of December, which is How I Does Filters by Peter Easley of Oxford Digital. Further details on the website if you want some more background on that. That meeting, of course, is also the annual general meeting. So if you are a member, and we'd like to come along to the AGM to hear Chairman's report and other exciting things, financial details, etc. Please do come along to that. Remember that that starts at 6:30. So the AGM starts at 6:30 and the lecture starts at 7 o'clock. Good to see lots of you there. Just to say a little bit about formatting tonight before I introduce our guests. Those of you who came to the equivalent event last year, which was with Bob Stewart, will know that that was organised in such a way that Bob and I sat at the front. We contrived to talk about particular topics, which coincidentally Bob had prepared presentations for. And he then gave those presentations, and then we chatted a bit more, he gave another presentation, and then three presentations in total, as I remember. Tonight's arrangement is not quite the same. Neville and I are going to talk initially. And then he's got a presentation prepared, which in fact touches on a number of different subjects, but he won't be coming back and forth once he starts on his presentation and preparing through those topics. So first, Noel, thank you very much for being here.
Wow, thank you for asking.
Great pleasure to see you. As many of the audience will probably know, Neville was over also at the Institute of Acoustic Conference last week, where he got the Peter Bartlett Award, so we're very grateful that he's also taken the chance to come and talk to us. What I'm going to do initially is, those of you who'd like to know more about Neville's background, there is a DVD here, which is part of the oral history project that the AES has in operation. This is an interview that was done with Neville in 2002 in Munich. This gives a lot more background about Neville's early years in particular than we are going to be able to talk about this evening, because we need to cut to the chase, so to speak. Those of you who'd like to know more, I recommend this. There is also one for Richard Small, and both of these, if any of you would like to buy them this evening, are available from Heather for £10 each. So ask Heather if you would like those. And while I'm thinking about Heather, excuse me just a second. Heather will remove parts of my anatomy if I don't send you the lead. It's happened before. I'm limping now. Right. Most of you will not need to be told who Neville Teal is. Anybody who's ever experimented with loudspeaker design will know the Teal small parameters and how useful and fundamental they are to designing speakers in a scientific and predictable fashion. What I want to do is just read to you a brief bio which takes us up to the point in Neville's life where the problem of designing loudspeakers loomed large and he sought a solution to it, which he will then describe the circumstances of to us. So let me just read this brief background which takes us up to that point. Neville Teal was born on 4th of December 1920 in an industrial suburb of Brisbane, Australia. He attended private school from the age of four before earning a scholarship to Brisbane Grammar School, from which he matriculated at age 15, too young to be accepted into university. So he repeated the final year at school, earning a scholarship to the university, only to be diverted into working in a bank instead to support the family coffers. This was, of course, in the 1930s when things were tough. His father was a pharmacist who hoped that Neville and his younger brother would both become doctors. But like many parents, his plans for his offspring were frustrated, initially because, a good singer himself, he encouraged his sons to sing too. As a result, they performed on Australian radio as early as 1932, as a result of which both became entranced by the medium, albeit in different ways. They later joined a radio repertory company and together built an acetate recording machine so as to be able to hear how they sounded when performing. Neville's brother went on to become a well-known actor in Australia, while Neville, having discovered equalisers and become interested in circuit theory as a consequence, had ambitions to become an engineer. World War II then intervened, during which Neville served in an infantry battalion in the Australian Army. But his interest in electronics was bolstered by attending signals training school and becoming what he calls an irregular signals mechanic instead of a machine guy when army radios began failing in the testing climatic conditions of the jungle. Following the war, he was offered a 4-year university course in electrical and mechanical engineering, following which he hoped to realise his dream of working in broadcasting by becoming an engineer with the Australian Broadcasting Commission. In fact, he was able to realise that later on, as he may tell us. But ABC stopped recruiting at the critical moment. So in 1952, he joined the Australian division of EMI instead, initially as an engineer in the Special Products Division, which developed telemetry for rockets. He was then invited to head up the team developing EMI Australia's first television receiver. A sideways move to becoming the company's advanced development engineer followed in 1957 as a result of his being less than enthusiastic about developing a cheaper, inferior TV receiver. But two significant events accrued from this. First, he became intimately acquainted with the work of Alan Dow Blumlein as a result of being asked to review his patent output in the years before his untimely death in 1942. As Neville explains this, there was a provision whereby you could make a claim that if you'd had patents which were taken out immediately before the war, you could add, I think, a five-year period to the patent run as a result of the war intervening. So that's why he was asked to review the patents and decide what might be worth applying for an extension to. And second, in 1959, he was asked to design the loudspeaker for a prestigious radio gramophone, a frustrating experience which was to have unexpected but happy consequences, not just for Neville, but for the world of audio at large. Right, tell us about that experience, though, because it wasn't an entirely happy one, was it?
Well, it certainly wasn't. But when it started off, I thought, this is my great opportunity. I've been asked to make a commercial, and they wanted a good quality loudspeaker. And so I said, well, now I've got a free hand. And they said, well, more or less, except the box has been designed. I said, oh, yes. Some of you have heard this sort of story before yourselves. Yes, it's a 2,000 cubic inch box. And I said, 2,000 cubic inches. I didn't know much. I thought I knew a lot about, like any 30-year-old, I thought I knew a lot about it. But at least I thought that 2,000 cubic inches was about the size for an 8-inch driver. And they said, no, this is prestigious. This is to be a 12-inch driver. And I said, I don't think it'll go into 2,000 cubic inches. And they said, well, that's what we're paying you for. So I had a go. And I tried everything. Some of you may know the ARU, the Acoustic Resistance Union, that Jordan did. I tried that. I tried to reverse engineer it, actually, and didn't work. I tried everything. I knew that vented boxes gave me a better opportunity, and they didn't. That didn't work. We got terrible sounds. In the end, with the chief engineer breathing down my neck, saying, come on, we want to put this into production, I just filled it up with absorbent material, sealed it up, and had a listen. And it had a great, enormous peak at 120 hertz. And the salespeople said, it sounds wonderful on cellos. They didn't say what it sounded like on male speech, of course. But so I'd been given the great opportunity to do this, and I had failed utterly. But in the process, I'd found that there was no rational way of designing loudspeakers in the 30s, 40s and 50s. There are all sorts of, you know, Venter and Turris, took out the patents in 1932 for Venter boxes. There are a whole lot of patents. And also, I might get a chance to show you later, Every Man and His Dog used to publish pictures of the impedance curves of loudspeakers. You'll still see them now. But people like Philips used to publish pages and pages of them. And I thought, well, somebody must understand this. I must be the only person in the world who's too stupid to know what it means. I don't know why they published it. There they were, they looked very pretty, and they didn't tell anybody anything. So, anyway, I'd seen it. And then, that episode was 1958. A little bit after, I think it was 59, Jim Novak published in the... it wasn't in the Journal of the AES, it was in the Audio and Acoustics Journal of the IEEE. And he laid out some of the work that Baranek had done, but again, he said, this is how it works. But he didn't say how you went about doing it. So I just sat down and tried to understand what went on. Now, I'd had the advantage that I'd been working, of course it used to be said, well, you know, if you're working in rocket science, well, I'd been working in rocket science, but all that I was doing was doing telemetry on rockets that went up on Australia's Woomera rocket range. They went up for 2 minutes and then they came down for 2 minutes, but we telemetered the stuff back. But there was work on filters there, and I became familiar. It's familiarity that's the important thing, with Butterworth filters, Chebyshev filters, and it suddenly started to dawn on me that all these great, the fourth order polynomial of a loudspeaker is pretty frightening when you look at it the first time, and it started to occur to me that maybe you could put the numbers, I know the numbers for a fourth order Butterworth, and that's the first order term and the third order term, both 2.6131, and the second order term is 3.4142, and I got to realize that if you could constrain things into this, you might be able to produce a Butterworth high-pass filter, because, after all, a loudspeaker can't reproduce down to DC, so it must be a kind of high-pass filter. So I realised you could do that, and then the question came, how did you measure it? And all of a sudden, it just seemed... I've tried to look at my notes to see where it, see signs of where it came. And all that happens is one day I write out about 4 pages of notes and the whole thing's there as if I'd, like the Mormons. I have to know Mormons here. And I got them from a thing on high. But anyway, there it was. And I had this thing and I said, this isn't too bad. But then the really wonderful thing, and people talk about the blissful moment you get a discovery. For me, it wasn't knowing that you could put, you turn a response into a Butterworth response, or that you could measure it. The weird thing was, I suddenly realized you could develop an expression for the electroacoustic efficiency of the thing. And I thought, wait a minute. I'm talking about conversion from electrical power to acoustic power. And I've taken no acoustic measurements. It's got to be wrong. So I did it 6 times with dimensional analysis, checking it, and it always came out. And finally, I thought, it must be. And it took about another 10 years, I think, before it suddenly occurred to me, yes, there is an acoustic measurement to be made, and that's the volume of a box. That if you get the volume of a testing box, that is because when it's V over rho C is the acoustic compliance of the box. And that was our one acoustic measurement. But the rest of it was all done with rather simple electrical measurements. Anyway, I've made too long. Have I made
no,
too
no, long? Fine. But now, having reached that stage,
yes,
you must tell us what the reaction of your bosses at EMI was to this great development.
Well, I shouldn't speak ill of the dead, I suppose. But they spoke pretty ill of me at the time. I went to management and I said, I think we've got something patentable. I said, just imagine, we could put these, when we make loudspeakers, and by the way, all our experimental work, wonderful thing, was done on car audio loudspeakers that was the only thing EMI made in Australia, and they were either 5-inch round or 5x7 elliptical. But of course, the wonderful thing is that you could smash them, you could do, cut out the surround, you could do what you liked, and what you weren't damaging much material. Anyway, I thought it was a good thing. I said, do you realise you get this little 8-inch driver, about this big, you put it in a box, about this big, and I can give you a bass that goes down to 50 hertz now. 50 hertz was pretty advanced stuff in 1961, and we can get, and I demonstrated, I said, we get tight, wonderful tight bass. And they said, look, young man, you've got delusions of grandeur. They said, our customers are perfectly happy with what we give them. We put things in a nice polished cabinet, and it was an open back. And who cares about tight bass and this? They are happy. And I said, well, we could patent it just the same. And I said, no. It's an academic exercise of no practical interest at all. Well, these people were older and more wiser than me, I thought. So I said, well, I published it. They said, you can do what you damn well please. So I published it in August 1961, and in September 1961, I went for an interview with a job with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and said goodbye to EMI. So that's the story. Oh, well, of course, the continuation was rather weird because I thought that I was being patriotic. I think, you know, it's the same as in the army. We used to say it's very difficult to tell the difference between bravery and stupidity. And in my case, I thought I was being patriotic to publish only in an Australian magazine. Well, the proper word for that is quixotic, of course. And but in 1964, 3 years after it was published, a young engineer called Richard Small came to... he'd come to Australia by way of Caltech, MIT, and he travelled around to Norway, Japan. He came to Australia... And he went to Sydney University to say, and said, I'd like to do a PhD in loudspeakers. And the professor was a friend of mine, and after a committee meeting one night, he said, I've got a crazy young American who's talking about a PhD in loudspeakers. There's no real PhD work in loudspeakers, is there? I said, Ron, I think there is. Oh, righto. And anyway, Dick started this work on that. And he also started talking to Ern Benson, which they're called the Teal... I don't know who named them the Teal Small Parameters, but there's an invisible man in here, Ernest Benson, who was a mentor, as people love to call it now, but a sort of father figure to Dick and me. And we got together. And anyway, Dick was taking my work and taking it further, finding a little error here, a little error there. and in particular what I had called QA, the acoustic cue of a loudspeaker, he called a QM for mechanical. He said the losses are more mechanical than acoustic. Well, that's anyway, that caught on, and that's where it stands. But he, Richard, got in touch with Professor Bob Ashley at the University of Colorado, and Ashley had connections with the Journal of the AES, and they published my paper, and then they published a series of about 10 papers of Dick's. And Dick said, you know, you did the wrong thing. You put everything into one 20,000-word paper. He said no self-respecting academic would do that. He'd divide it up into about 5 papers of 4,000 words each. And I said, well, I'm not an academic. I'm just a design engineer. Well, Dick was an academic, and he strung out his... Well, and was good stuff. It's lovely explanatory stuff. And as I said, a lot of it was novel. So there we were. Dick published in the... my paper was republished in the Journal of the AES. It had gone nowhere, apart from university people. It had gone absolutely nowhere in Australia. I was the idiot who said, I'm going to publish only in Australia. They republished in 71, and then Dick's papers came out between 72 and 73, and there are other papers of Ernest Benson's that he'd also published in Australia in the AWA review, and nobody had taken much interest of. And anyway...
But there was one person, at least in the UK, who'd spotted your paper, wasn't there?
Oh, Laurie yes, Fincham. There was. It's cunning old devil. Laurie Fincham. Laurie Fincham had got hold of the Australian paper in 1964. And, of course, he told me since that he thought it was so valuable, he kept it very quiet to himself. He didn't want anybody else beating him commercially on this. And, by the way, about beating commercially... One of the things that I have to say, and there's really a sort of political message in this, that Dick and Ernie and I, only we collaborated as friends. We never worked in the same lab, and we never competed with each other. It was pure cooperation the whole way. And I've spoken to a particularly senior American engineer who said, couldn't happen in the United States. But it was pure friendship, and three of us and three wives, one wife each, of course.
I thought I'd better explain you. You know, Australians have a reputation for being a bit strange in some ways. We used to meet over Sunday afternoon, and sometimes we'd talk about loudspeakers, and other times it was purely social. And... anyway, but it's a matter of the whole thing that the whole world seems... That the people who run the world have tried to persuade us all that competition is the great thing about society. That society succeeds through competition. And as far as I'm concerned, that is a lie. It may be partially true, but to think of it as a total truth is wrong, wrong, wrong. And we simply cooperated, we still do. I send, if I write a paper and there's time enough, I send to Dick, who gives me wonderful comments on it. And anyway, it's a result of cooperation. Right. Is that enough?
Yes, indeed. Right. You are going to explain in a moment.
About the parameters?
Yes, in just a moment. Because, as I said to you, I suspect that the audience will be comprised of people who know full well what the Teal's Hall parameters are, people who think they know what the Teal's Hall parameters are, and those who've heard of them but really don't know what they are. So Neville is going to start his presentation this evening before moving on to other topics. By a quick explanation of the parameters.
Okay. Well, what I've chosen to do is to tell you first of all, in very short form, what the parameters are, and the other thing the important thing was, and this is why people had so much trouble before the time of the parameters, to show what happens when you use the wrong parameters, because it's what I came to call an alignment. You know, you've got to have a set of three, or in the case of vented boxes, five parameters that all are properly related to each other. And if you get them wrong, you can get some horrendous results. So I'll demonstrate that.
Right. Right now. Now, that's... So one of the troubles about this is my... Oh. Oh, well, I'll go back. Sorry. Oh, no. Help, it says. Yeah, it looks like. Next. Just a minute.
What was the camera?
That's right. Now, that's me dad, that's me mum, and that's me and me brother, if that's any use. Yeah. Now, unfortunately, I have to go right through these ones. These have to do with early broadcasting. But, the trouble is that I put all this in. I wanted to see what Keith felt would most interest you. And just a minute. I'll go back one. Yeah, well, that's the AMI. Anybody know the BTR one? That the first. Oh, sorry, the first magnetic tape recorder. I'd worked with those in the ABC studios when I did my what we called 6 months hard labour at the end of third year. You went out and did practical training. And they were the first... They were the first tape recorders. They weren't really... Those were the first broadcast ones, anyway. 30 inches a second. They were on big platters like that, continental platters. And they only, as I said, they ran 22 and a half minutes, and if you had a symphony or a long politician's talk, you ran machine. You had all the machines in pairs. Two of them, number one had started. By the time it got to 20 seconds, you started number two, and you recorded the same program on the tail of number one and the head of number two. And then when you got to the end of the 22 minutes... You put a new tape on machine number one. And when you played them back, you you went to 20 seconds, not quite 20 seconds, a bit early, started machine number two, and you had two loudspeakers, and you slowed down number two until they coincided. And then when at a suitable time, like when a politician paused for breath or when there was a quiet piece, part of the symphony, press the button and away you went. But that's that one. Oh, yes, now that one, dear old Gilbert Briggs, a great man. Anybody read Gilbert Briggs? Yes. Well, Gilbert Briggs set my understanding of loudspeakers back about 5 years, I reckon. He reckoned that when you put a loudspeaker in a vented box, that the loudspeaker resonance went down, but another air resonance started up on the other side. And I couldn't understand what the mechanism was. But he did a lot of very interesting work. But one of the things he did was demonstrated live sound versus recorded sound at the Royal Festival Hall, 1955. Now, out of sight on the left was the Goldsmith Choir, and then the Goldsmith Choir would sing, and at a predetermined moment they would stop, and a pre-recorded thing of the same piece and would be played on a BTR. That's a BTR. I'm sorry.
BTR 2.
That's the BTR. Sorry. Is that a BTR 2,
but yes, it's a BTR 2. No doubt about it.
There was no BTR 3, was there?
Yes, it was, but later. It was developed.
We didn't make many then. We made a BTR 4.
Yes.
Anyway.
BTR 3
So I was, I defer. Yep. But it was, anyway, one of the BTR things, and played on these Wharfdale's corner loudspeakers. And the idea was, our Wharfdale loudspeakers are so good, you can't tell the difference. And the answer is, of course you can't. By the time you play it into the festival hall, the whole thing is coloured by the acoustics of the festival hall. But we don't talk about things like that. The other point of interest, purely of interest to me, and I wish my wife was here tonight, because this picture was taken by an EMI engineer who is sitting in the row behind me. And those two heads together, that is me and that is my wife. We had been married about 15 months by then. That's why we still had our heads together. So, anyway, now I'm really digressing. I'm sorry, Frank. Come on. Oh dear, this says go to next. I'm not used to this thing. Somehow, I've got to get out of this.
Is that a previous escape key or something?
Ah, righto. Good. Now, the... I've jumped one, I think. No, that's previous. Now, this is typical. This is really introduction. At last I'm getting around to an introduction on the parameters. This, I'd love to say that this is a book that I carried over the mountains as a highly irregular infantry signaller. I was properly a machine gunner, but nobody else could fix the gear when it broke down. And I carried this in my bag. Now, this, you will find this if you ever buy the book. It's the Radiotron, I think it's called the Radio Designer's Handbook now.
Langford Smith. Langford Smith.
Yeah. Now, this one you'll notice is third edition, eighth impression in 1942. They were turned out, impressions of a few thousand each, turned out one after the other to train soldiers. And it's still good reading even now. Even it's all valves and things like that. But the base, a lot of the base is still there. Anyway, that's what it was. This is one of the. One of the things that I looked at, I'd love to say that that's my other sweat, that's coloured with my sweat as I marched over the mountains. The truth is that the copy that I had got so ragged in my army pack. This is one that my mother sent me when I was in Leh after the Salamaua campaign. Anyway, now, this is, of course, this was one of the most exciting parts of the 1961 paper. And what it showed... Oh, blank. Thank you. What it showed was that not the one loudspeaker, but with a driver with the same frequency. Let's say it's 50, a resonant frequency of 50 hertz, that you could get this variety of responses. Now that's F over FS is one there. Let's say that FS is 50. It meant that you could be 3 dB down I'll explain later about this, in a box of a certain size at 50 hertz, or you could put it in a smaller box and still get a flat response up here. But, of course, the smaller box, you wouldn't get as much low-frequency response. But the interesting thing was that even if you've got a 50 hertz driver, you can take it down to, this is about 38 hertz, something like that, and get a Chebyshev response, an equal ripple response, with a ripple, I think that one is a half a dB, but you can see it's still, by loudspeaker standards, what you would call really flat. But what you have to do is to use the right
ratios of parameters. Now, here we say F3 over FS. F3 is where it's 3 dB. And to do this with a vented box, you need to tune FB. Number 5 is that. That's number 5. For that one, you need F3 over FS. 50 Hz driver gives you 50 Hz response. You need to tune it to 50 Hz. You need a ratio of CAS to CAB. That really has to do with box sizes. And this is a bit confusing, because a bigger box means a smaller number here. You see, if the number's on the bottom there, you get this one is with a value of CAB for the box, a bit lower than the driver, 1.41. And you need what we call QT, which I'll explain in a moment, head 38. Now, with the smaller box, with a bigger CAS over CAB, you could get 1.8 roughly. That would be about 90 Hz response. You'd tune the box to about 70 Hz, and you'd need a very low QT, this other parameter. If you haven't struck it before, don't worry. These are numbers that we'll talk about. On the other hand, if you've got a really big box, small number here, big box, you can go down to 32 Hz, 3 dB, at 32 Hz. You tune the box to 38 Hz, and you need a rather big QT. Anyway, but the exciting thing was that you could get this variety of responses with the same frequency for the driver by using the right alignment, the right constellation, the right set or group of parameters. Now, of course, this is the other one. This is Richard Small, dear old Richard, taken in 2005. We're mates. We still are good mates. Oh, and of course, oh, this is the other part of the story of my life. This has to do with Neil Gilchrist. He was chairman of a working party of CCIR, and did quite a bit there. And we developed this together. He insists that it's my work. I insist it's a joint effort. Cooperation again, you see. Anyway. That's my brother who... I hadn't intended to do that. That's my brother who... This Is Your Life. Do you ever see that crummy program? A famous person is interviewed and gets his relations and the blokes that he flew his Wellington with during the war and all this sort of thing. And anyway, that's me, of course, and that's the compa. Sorry, this... And that's me getting my DSC in architecture, because the only people who cared enough about audio were the professor of acoustics in the architecture department. That's my wife on the left, and my son and daughter, etc. Now, get out, family. This is this. Now we really will talk about parents. Sorry, Keith. I warned you that if I got into this, you'd take your time to get me out. The essence of this is that you idealize that impedance curve that you God help us. I'm sorry, I've lost it. Anyway, I think you all know what an impedance curve looks like. Yeah. You idealize this thing, and you pretend that there's no inductance there. And of course, that varies enormously with the kind of loudspeaker. But you say that is a symmetrical curve, which works surprisingly well. Now, You take that as a symmetrical centre. You take measurements of that frequency there, and the impedance R naught at that frequency, and you take the readings at another impedance, any impedance in principle. But unfortunately, that was I didn't sit on the draftsman heavily enough. Really, that should be somewhere near the geometric mean between R naught and the DC resistance RE. So really, it should, if it's a logarithmic scale, it'd be halfway up. But really, that would sit down there. The reason you do it is that you get it, you need to know the difference between that frequency F1 and that frequency F2, and you want that to be as big as possible. And also, the slope is greatest down here. This sort of thing up the top here appeals to people who are used to RF measurements and love to take that as 3 dB down from the peak. That's fine if the Q is greater than 5, but most of the Qs you will get in loudspeakers are less than 5. And this will read them down to 0.15 if you want. So that was, I suppose you could say that was one of the discoveries on the... I wish this would stop doing this. Now, these are the parameters. 5 main parameters. FS, the resonance frequency of the driver. That's pretty straightforward. RE, the DC resistance of the voice coil. Now, the next one is QE, the electrical quality factor. It's a Q like any Q, not to be confused with Q, which is also used for directional properties of loudspeaker. Forget that Q. This is an electrical Q, has to do with the amount of damping. The bigger the number, the lower the damping. Now, that is, and we go back to here, that is the... Where am I? Yep. Now, if we consider that, that has a reactance at resonance, that L, C, and R. Now, that has a reactance at resonance, and Q is the ratio of that resistance there to the reactance at resonance of this. And it's measured by this surprisingly simple thing. This test, I mean, the test could hardly be simpler. It's in McLaughlin, 1934. All you need is a generator, and you need to know the frequency of the generator. The purpose of that voltmeter is simply to know that you've got a constant voltage across there at all times. And you can say, well, but that shunts this. Well, it does, but if that's 20k ohms and that's 4 ohms, well, I mean, you could forget about that. And you test either a check resistor there or this, and you measure the current there. Now, these days, we used a beautiful AVA model 7 amplifier, not ammeter, beautiful things. Nobody knows them now, but there are other ways of doing it now. Anyway, QE is the ratio of that to this, the reactance of resonance. QM is the ratio of that resistance to that reactance of resonance. Now, you can see if you feed this from a zero impedance of an amplifier, really, what damps this circuit is that resistor in parallel with that. Now remember, this one gives us QE, this gives us QM, and when we put the two together in parallel, you get QT, the total one. The reason we publish them separately is that if you're going to put resistances in here due to the resistance of passive crossover or something like that, it will add to RE, so it will increase QE in the same proportion. So you keep them separate, and then at the last moment, when you're doing a design, there's QE, as I said, there's QM, mechanical quality factor, and QT, the two combined as resistors in parallel, like that.
Now, that's those ones. Now, there is another one, VAS, the volume of air equivalent to the acoustical compliance of the driver, and specified in litres, or in the early days we did it in cubic inches. But it controls the response in because of its relationship with the size of the box. Now, that's because remember, this is really effectively a compliance. So you can write it as either VAS over VB or as CAS over CB. It's exactly the same quantity. But the important thing is because the box size is on the bottom line. The larger the box, the smaller is the figure for that. In his publication, Dick Small calls this alpha. Now, that's all you need for a closed box. If you go to a vented box, the next thing that you want is FB, the box resonance. That's the frequency where the mass of air in the vent resonates with the compliance of the air in the box. And if that sounds a bit exotic, just think of the trick, you know, blowing across the top of a bottle, you get a boom sound. Well, that's a bottle behaving as a Helmholtz resonator. It's exactly the same thing. You wouldn't, if you had a box as big as we use for low frequency loudspeakers, just be way, way down there. Now, then there are two other less important parameters, which I won't go into. There's the leakage Q has a small effect. Well, in some circumstances, quite a considerable effect. And the other is the voice coil inductance. Now, I'm still working on voice coil inductance. It may sound funny to say that that is still not right. We still can't measure it properly. There have been attempts. There was an attempt by an Australian, Ian Dash, who was one of Dick Small's, one of his students, who found that there's a component in it. I put that in blue because it includes, at one stage I thought it was the whole story, but it's not. A part of the impedance is the semi-inductance, which has this rather odd a property that it varies inversely with square root of frequency. But really, the easy way of thinking it is that its reactance goes up with the square root of frequency, and associated with it is a resistive component of the same value. And that is not as exotic as you might think. The same similar thing happens in electrical cables. So some people, there are all sorts of people publish that inductance measured at different frequencies, and I can assure you that if you don't specify the frequency at which the inductance is measured, you might as well go home. You really must specify the inductance along with the frequency where it's measured. So that's the story of the. It's very quick. It's been too long for those of you who know the parameters, and it's too short for those who don't. But that's this time that's as much as we can go. Now, as a result of that, you can get a formula for the frequency response, and of course you write it in the S form here. But the form that you use to calculate in the in a computer is this one, and it's a minor complexity. Once it's written into a computer, it's dead easy to use. Now, it used to be, of course, one of the things was in the early days, I'm not talking about the year 20 BC, but in the year about, 1960, most engineers always got pictures of an engineer holding a slide rule. Well, a slide rule is only accurate one in part in 400. And you start doing some of these things with a slide rule, you'll get into strife very quickly. And the one thing about my notes for this is all down the right-hand column, a series of four-finger logs. You did everything, multiply four-finger logs and then taking the anti-log. And that was the only way we could get decent results. Nowadays, it's a joke. The computer's what, 16-digit precision. So it doesn't apply anymore. But that's the expression you get. In fact, when you put a loudspeaker in a box, you get the same expression, but you have to convert it to get the frequency component is modified by 1 plus CS over CAB, and the QT here is modified the same way. As you put a smaller and smaller box, the frequency goes up more and QT goes up more. And you put that into into your computer or whatever you've got, and away you go. Now, this is what happens when you get different sort of alignments. This is the one that works nicely. The red one is if you've got the loudspeaker on a flat baffle. You've measured, put it on a flat baffle so that CA is over CB, CAB is virtually infinite, so that figure is zero. Then you've got a QT of 1 over root 2, and you get that. Now, if you put it into a smaller box, and this particular smaller box has a CAS over CAB of 1, so 1 plus 1 is 2, so you change things by root 2. If you do that and make QT of your driver smaller, they still get this flat, this Butterworth response, it's still flat, flat, flat. That's fine. All you're doing is losing half an octave of response. And when you put it into a smaller box, and in this special case where this is 3, you'll get it going, changing. The 3dB point is there, changes exactly from 20 to 40 hertz. Now, but you see, that's fine. But now, if you get all the parameters right, except that you get QT wrong. The red one is a reference one where everything is all right. This is assuming a very big box or a flat baffle. If QT is up to a figure of 2, you will get a peak of 6 dB at that frequency. So you don't want QT to be too big. On the other hand, if you make QT too small, you'll get this thing which just dies, dies, dies. So you watch that you've got the right QT. If you put it in the wrong size box, if you put it in, again, this is the right size box. If you put it in too small a box, you'll get the magenta figure where it cuts off earlier, gives you a peak, 4 dB, it'll boom. On the other hand, if you put it into if that increase there, you will get a different response there. So it ought to be right. But one of the problems that turned up, people used to say, but after a while, my loudspeakers parameters change. And the answer is yes, of course they do. When a loudspeaker is exercised a lot, when it's used a lot, the edge is, in my experience, it always loosens up. But I believe some people say that some sort of surrounds harden up. But if the compliance, and only the compliance, changes, it will change the resonant frequency FS, it'll change compliance, of course, CAS, and it'll also change QT. But all those, if it's
driver compliance only, the way those work together, strangely, doesn't, these are for variations of 2-to-1. This is 2-to-1 increase in compliance, the thing getting looser, and this is if it's difference up. And look, by the, when you're out here, right around this 3 dB point, from here up, there's a change of no more than a dB all the way, plus, wow, plus or minus a dB. So aging of a loudspeaker doesn't vary too much. Oh, gee. Do you think I ought to try my little funny on this? We'll see. How do you think this audience will react? Well, we'll see. I was in a certain place, which will remain nameless to protect the people who are there, and said, well, you see, this is the sort of thing that happens when a loudspeaker gets older and it gets flabby. I said, it's rather like loudspeaker designers, you know, as they get older, they get flabby. But just remember it in the same thing there. So, see, I told you, it doesn't go down very well. Yeah. Anyway, so that's end of closed boxes. Now, then we go to vented boxes. And you look at, the top one is including losses in the box, assuming no losses, assuming a very nice clean box, this one with losses in the box. They both look pretty horrendous. Now, the whole point is, they took a bit of work to work out, but as far as using them goes, when your wife or your mother goes to make a cake, she doesn't have to be trained in food chemistry. She doesn't have to know how things react. But she says, the recipe says that I need 2 cups of flour, 3 cups of sugar. I've never made a cake myself, but, you know, so many eggs and all the rest. And she mixes them up and you make a nice cake. And that's what this thing does. You put the right numbers into there and you get a smooth Butterworth. Or you might get a Chebyshev. And so there's nothing to be frightened of that you... I mean, if you've got to do it by hand, it's just messy. It's just a long time. With a computer, so long as you write your program accurately, you just put that in and press a button and away it comes. The other thing that this shows is that if there's no losses, the CAS over CBA is 1.414. If you've got QL of 7, which, again, Dick's done this work, not me, he says if you don't know what it is, you can generally say that it's around about 7. And that this value is 1.061. Note that changed from 1.414 to 1.061. That means the box is a third as big again. So in general, you have to make the box somewhat bigger. And people like Vance Dickerson's Loudspeaker Cookbook and publications like that will tell you what you can get. Dick has done nomograms that do it very easily. If you get a really lossy box, look what we get here. See, you can still make a fourth order Butterworth, but this has gone down to 654. In other words, you need a box 2.16 times the volume. So you want to avoid box losses. Now, what happens in the original paper? These ones assume no box losses. But you can see that if we take figure 4, F3 over FS, if this figure is 1 in the use, this one that we've been talking a lot about, the Butterworth, but you can, with a smaller box, with smaller, also it's small, the CAS over CAB is 10, it'll go down to 2.68, but you've got to have a low QT. On the other hand, you can, if you've got a big box 0.485, that's quite big. You can tune the box to 0.7, if it was 50 hertz, that'd be, you tune to 35 hertz, and this would go down to 34. You'd be 3 dB down to 34. But you've got a variety of responses now with a vented box. But the trouble with a vented box is that you've got to be more careful. I mean, it's like all complex filters. The more complex the filters, the more care that you need to take. And I really have developed the idea that when people come to me and say, what should I use? Should I use a closed box or a vented box? You look them hard in the eye and say, I wonder if this bloke really understands very well. If he doesn't, you say, I think you ought to use a closed box. You just do it, just apply a few principles, and you can't go far wrong, because you know that it's too easy to go wrong in a vented box. If you trust him, then you'll say, oh, you could use a vented box. You can get more base out of it. But you've got to be sure that he's got the right background and the right tools to do it with. Now, you've seen this one before. But the important thing is that these are curve number 3, 5, and 8 of that table. Now, we say now the red curve, as usual, is the Butterworth. Now, but then we've been a bit sloppy about QT. Now, if QT doubles, the response will double up there. And if it's too small, the response will halve. So you see, a similar thing occurs out here, but you don't notice it as much. There is a point here where you've got a maximum of 6 dB change there and 6 dB down there. But this is what worries you most, that if that's not right, well, I'm sorry, you're going to get some strange responses. On the other hand, if everything is right except the box size, and you've got a bit more timber, I'm sorry, than you thought you had, and you put it in a big box, all the other parameters being the same, you'll get look at it, 9 dB peak there, at where you thought you were getting 3 dB down. On the other hand, if the box is too small, well, you'll get terrible response. And then again, if you tune to the wrong frequency, this one here, this is the proper tuning. This is one, if you tune too low, it will die early. If you tune too high, you'll get a 5 dB peak, nice boomy thing out there. But again, you've got this strange, lovely thing, that if only the compliance varies, and only the compliance, as when the loudspeaker getting out of it, for a 2-to-1 change of compliance, that's, look at this, for increased compliance, that's half a dB just about. And if it gets stiffer, well, it's not quite as good. It goes down about 1.5. But it's not too bad. So you don't have to worry too much about the driver aging. Now, but then there's another one. If, for example, you say, oh, this is all too hard. Look, I'll get beautiful bass response. What I'll do is buy one of JBL's great big drives with huge magnets and QTs of about 0.2. And then I'll put it in an enormous box. And we'll be sure to get bass there. And then we tune it to a low frequency. That will, with all those things, that will ensure that we get wonderful bass. And that's what you'll get. That's the one that you hope to get. And this one goes like that. It drops down to nearly minus 9 dB. It's a cautionary tale. It's Dick Small's story, so I won't go into detail. But that is really a cautionary tale. And the whole object of this part of the exercise has been to explain that you can do wonderful things so long as you know what the parameters are and you use the right set of them together.
Well, that's now we're on to another subject. Keith, that's the piece on the parameters. Now, yeah. Yes,
we're,
I know, it's
10 past 8 now, Neville, so we've got time for another topic at least.
Time for... Well, look, if we got... Well, I'll go through to the end. One of the things is that if you... This, if you can feed a driver through... Oh, hello. That's one. If you feed a driver simply through a capacitor, you can turn from a second order response to a third order. And you don't... there's some of the earlier part here is how you can correct the impedance. But if you, again, if you've got the right... parameters, you can just put a single capacitor there, and if it's all right, and that one used to be 16 ohm loudspeakers, like when we did the work years ago, that would be about 250 microfarads. These days that capacitor with 4 ohms, of course it's up to about 1,000. But if you're prepared to do that, strange as it might seem, that will take your response lower. You can get more bass. Now, I thank you for nodding and agreeing, but I think quite a few people know, but there's an awful lot don't. There's always the feeling that if you put a capacitor in series, you must muck it up. And just think, you get more bass, and yet at very low bass, the response is going off and you're being kinder to the excursion of the current. So that was that one. And these are simply to tell you that you've got to have the right ratio of QM to QE. But I won't go into detail on those. There they are. There. There's another idea. This is something that I rather like. There's an asymmetrical crossover. I did this work in 1972, and then got a heart attack, and it all seemed to get too hard, and I thought people wouldn't be interested anyway, so I just didn't do anything. When I started to, much later, about the year 2000, I started to use this again, and somebody said, aren't you aware that Malcolm Hawksford has done this? And I said, no. I hadn't read my journal, and Malcolm did it in 1992, so Malcolm published, but he hadn't published all the stuff that I knew, so I did the naughty thing. I did another paper called Implementing Asymmetrical Crossings, where I was able to put in the extra material and also explain some things about this. Now, one of the nice things about this, it mayn't be obvious, but that blue one is a third order Butterworth, 18 dB per octave. This one is a third order high pass Butterworth concatenated with a second order Butterworth filter of a crossover whose 3 dB down point is half an octave higher. Doesn't look like it, but if you look hard, you'll see that it's rather slower at the start there. The interesting thing is that it crosses, where it crosses over is, this point here, is about minus 6 dB. And of course, that means that at that point, they add additively. They don't add in quadrature as the odd order Butterworths do. And so it has a lot of the properties of Linkwood Rileys. And anyway, I'm rather keen on this is the detail. Again, this is in papers that I published, and it shows that if you use that high pass, there's second order Butterworth. There's a third order Butterworth. Sorry, all that. That's a second order Butterworth, half an octave above. There's a simple third-order Butterworth there. And when you add those two together, miraculously, you get that, which is an all-pass. And so it's amplitude responses, flat, flat, flat. I better not go into that. And this is to show that you can make it like that, where you, and the point I continually make, people don't often realise that really the proper way of designing a crossover, if you can do it, is to include the response of the driver in the crossover filter. This one is a fifth order, but it's a third order electrical filter, plus all the stuff in the box here is the driver. Unfortunately, we've got to go through, and this shows that you've got to have the right QM and QE to do it. Now, and there's this strange paradox now. The red curve is a third order Butterworth, and you can make a perfectly valid all-pass crossover in two ways. One is to put a third order Butterworth like that, or the alternative is to use this strange fifth order one. Now, notice this one adds in quadrature, the 3 dB down, they add in quadrature. This one is nearly 6. So that the phase angle is at the crossover is not 360, it's about 373. But it behaves very much like a Butterworth. And the lovely thing, behaves very much like Linkwood Trolley. The lovely thing about a Linkwood Trolley is that if things go wrong with phase rotation because of time alignment or whatever, a Linkwood Trolley is much more forgiving. The sort of amplitude error you get for a given phase error, look, is it 1 dB at plus or minus, 50, I think it is. Yes, 55 degrees. So you can have quite a lot of error there. This, on the other hand, is adding in quadrature. It drops very quickly. That's 100 degrees, but that's where it should be. If you go out to 50 degrees, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you're up about 2.5 dB. Well, out here, you'll be down about 4, I think. It's 3, 1, 2... Anyway, you're down the wrong way. So, and of course, one of the points that I keep wanting to make, and I think this will drive Graham mad, but one of the things is that the lower that you cross over, the less trouble you're likely to have with time alignment. These correspond to different crossover frequencies. And if you've got, you would say, 20 millimetres is a small error. Well, that's a red one. But 20 millimetres, if you're crossing over 2 kilohertz, will might give you 20, 30, 40 degrees, which in Linkwood Trolley is quite acceptable. If you go up to 4 kilohertz crossover, you've got an error here of 85. That's a point to remember. And this is why I have been trying to persuade people, nobody will listen to me, they'll say you'll destroy my business if you do this, because you'll have me burning out all my tweets when people mistreat them. So that's maybe. Now, there's this last one. If Keith will bear with me for this one, that's all. In 1959, I did a paper which was published only in Australia, and it seems to have dropped like a rocket. And yet, I think it's important, and I've had people make remarks at AES conferences where, in one case, Dick, the man carried on about amplifiers, about what happens under overload, and dear old Dick got up and said, look, I don't know what your argument is, too, published this paper in 1959 about it. So I've got the cheek, seeing I've got you as a captive audience, to just try this one out on you again, only 50 years later. When an amplifier is overloaded, even momentarily, energy can be stored in its reactive and the usually capacitive coupling elements that puts it into an incorrect operating condition. Now, when the overload's removed, remember, this can happen in a matter of milliseconds when you overload an amplifier. But then when you remove the overload, the energy quite often dissipates quite slowly. And these effects can last for about half a second. And the effect also is aggravated by negative feedback. So when you put, 30, 40 dB of feedback on your amplifier, this really makes a mess of it. Now, unfortunately, the illustrations are in valves, and of course that'll drive you mad. But as Graham says, well, tell them that a valve is like a FET without a filament. So think of it as a... No, it's not quite true because the base doesn't conduct. Yeah. Anyway, but the mechanism to happen. Now, I'm going... Before I tell you how it happens, I'll tell you how you test for it. You put in an attenuator, you've got a signal coming in here, and you close that there, and that gives you 20 dB. 560 with Tavenin 5K gives you 20 dB. So you just run that, use that, and bring the amplifier up to 10 dB under peak power. Remember, this is a 20 dB attenuator. Now, when you open the switch, of course, the thing will be 10 dB overloaded. Now, I quote this because it's an IEC standard. And for all that it's an IEC standard, in what used to be called Publication 268, I've never seen it. We developed it independently using 6 dB and 12 dB because the principle's the same. So the thing is that you start it well under clipping, and then you belt it so that it's well and truly clipping, and then you take it out again. Now, what happens, you might be surprised to know, is assume this is... That this is 10 dB below full output, and this is what maximum output is. Now, when you take that filter out, of course, it will overload there. In fact, there it is. Now, when you take it out, I don't know if it'll be to your surprise, what will happen is you expect it to come back just like that. It doesn't. Most amplifiers will come down where it necks down there and then takes its time coming up there. And that time can be anything. Maybe a second is too long, but certainly half a second. Worse than that, in some amplifiers, the DC axis will shift. And if you think what that does to your audio for a tiny momentary overload, you get that. That's one of the reasons why you get awful, why you amplify sound so awful. But now, the mechanism is that here we have an incoming signal, and I've drawn them triangular because I'm a pretty bad draftsman. That's the incoming signal. That's the feedback signal here. So the difference between the two is this one here. This difference transfers to there. Now, when you put a bigger signal in, this feedback signal, of course, will just go up so far and no further. It'll go up to that peak if that was just under clipping level. It will go up to there. And while this is drawn here, in fact, you'll get a peak if it's 20 dB 10 times. That'll be an enormous peak going up there. And it will belt the early parts of the amplifier and give all these charge-up schemes the greatest possible chance of happening.
and that is why it takes a while to come out. Now, so just repeating this thing, after even a momentary overload, the amplifier can remain in a distorting state until the energy storage stored by the overload leaks away, and that could last for, I was going to say, nearly a second, and then I changed it to say a significant part, but it really is. Now, this, I'm sorry, those of you who haven't got used to valves, but what happened in this, when you have overload in a valve amplifier, this grid here acts as a diode. It will conduct. Now, the usual form used to be that you used about half a megahertz, half a mega ohm there. You had a little resistor in here that was called a grid stopper, stopped oscillation. And if you were like me, you put in a nice big capacitor. The fore and after ones, the ones in brackets of before, you put in a nice big capacitor to make sure that your base response was not compromised in any way. Now, what we found, and this, we just noticed this from observation, that when you got, we had HT to the audio amplifier on the same rail as the vertical output signal. We found that when the, you know, you've got this on the television set, when you've got overload, the thing will come down here. Now, when the overload was taken off, did it go like that? No, it went doing like this and then came back slowly. And that's what put us up to it. And the solution is so simple, it was ridiculous. We did it by cheapening the design. We used another resistor of the same value, put a larger one in there. We put a much larger one in here, so that when this conducted, this diode didn't have nearly as much chance of charging that capacitor. And anyway, it worked beautifully, and I quote, this is quoting my own stuff from the 1959 paper, because quite honestly, when I came back, I thought maybe my memory had slipped a bit, but this is quoted directly. In listening tests conducted with that amplifier you just saw, and also with a push-pull amplifier using two designed on a similar basis, program peaks could be seen to flatten on a cathode ray tube about 3 dB before they were detected by ear. You know, you come up to distortion and then you get this little bright up on the oscilloscope. We could run it up in 3 dB before we heard nasty distortion. And when it came to... and on speech, we reckoned that even went to 6 dB. Now, this is the result of 4 or 5 of us in the lab. It's not what you'd call a well-controlled experiment. But the effect was real. Now, the one thing I won't guarantee is the actual numbers on those dBs. But my goodness, it worked. And of course, I hate salespeople. What happened? Did we get thanks for this? Not on your life. We were told that we had made things a mess of it. We used a bigger valve than Pi used on theirs. And we'd been very careful, you couldn't overload it too much. We just were careful with the FM signal. And that with Pi, with only a 2-watt amplifier, theirs sounded louder than ours. So, anyway. So, I said at the end, while such subjective results must be assessed with caution, they do indicate the substantial improvement. 3 dB, for heaven's sake, is twice the power. And I don't recommend this music power nonsense or anything like this, but this sort of thing happens on transistor amplifiers. And in fact, when I was research director for the ABC, I managed to get our specification changed in the way that I'll show in this slide here. Now, we'll go through these.
ABC standards for distortion on analog magnetic tape were 2% THD at plus 8 above alignment level. American standards at the time were 3% at 6 dB above alignment level. That's even lower. Remember those figures, 8 and 6. Now, our standards for distribution amplifiers, which we had to be more careful of because you have a great chain of them, we allowed a quarter percent at 12 dB above alignment and no clipping until plus 16. Now, that was considered pretty avant-garde at the time, and a certain maker of desks, who I will not name, told us that he'd got, by meeting this ABC specification, he'd got a great commercial advantage over his competitors. And just to point this, digital standards, peaks correspond to plus 18. Digital standards now are plus 18 or plus 20, depending which standard you get, above alignment. But you will see with that this onset of distortion here, 8 dB, compared with what we worked, there was an 8 dB leeway. And in one case, there was a man who was recovering jazz records, and he had this problem. There used to be a device, one of the early things for denoising records was you've got a mono record, has a V-shaped notch, and you'd play it with a stereo head so that you got a signal off a left and right. And in Pacburn's gear, all it simply did was had a switchery scheme that it took the one with the lower amplitude. It reckoned if you got a low amplitude out of the track, that must be the one that wasn't mucked up. Now, this man, and of course, what to do this, you'd have to play the record a few times to get your clipping levels right and all that sort of thing. And of course, if you gave him a mint record and said, you won't mind if I play it 10 times before I hand it back to you, you'd likely to say, sorry, won't play, mate. So what he decided to do was record it on analog tape. And he found that the analog tape just killed the scratch, the ping, you know, when you get a piece out of the wall of the disc. And he had to go to digital to do it. But this loss of sharp transients on analog tape, remember, we're a broadcasting organisation like BBC who are anxious for the highest quality, and we were all clipping at these horrendous amounts, 8 from 16, were clipping with 2%, it might have gone up quite a bit. But the wonderful thing is, if you've ever wondered why loudspeakers you can stand 5 to 10% distortion in a loudspeaker, where you won't stand 1 or 2% in an amplifier. The reason is that amplifiers usually clip paralytically in this way that I said, whereas loudspeakers and analog tape, they clip and immediately come out again. But this is a thing to consider in designing amplifiers. That's it. I've run over time, as I said if there's anything I hate when I'm a chairman, it's people who run over time. So please forgive me.
Right. Thank you, Neville. We want to leave time for people to say hello to you in person at the end of this before we have to pack up. But before that, I'm sure we've got some questions from the floor. Please wait for the microphone if you want to ask questions.
Dr. Teal, do we know enough about speakers, boxes and waves to move on to the digital domain, or should we actually spend a bit more time with the analog signals?
We've never got out of the analog system. I keep... Thank you for the question, but the...
I tell students, it's all very well to rabbit on about the difference between analog and digital, that in fact digital is, well, the French have got it right, they call it numérique. Instead of using a voltage or a flux, the amplitude of a flux or voltage, they have the amplitude of a number. And the main, I mean, I'm not pretending that there's no difference. Digital has the great advantage that it's more stable. When you think what we used to do with adjust on test resistors and you know, varying potentiometers to get things right, you'd say, hey, that's part of the Dark Ages. And that's the difference. And you've got to remember that there are Class D amplifiers now, of course, but we still have a lot of analog amplifiers, and we have almost all analog loudspeakers. So I'm asking for respect for the analog domain, if you don't mind.
I just wonder what your thoughts are on speakers with low density.
Oh dear, this is where my hearing aids start to patter.
Speakers with low density gas behind them instead of normal air.
Low density gas behind them?
Yeah, why aren't they more popular?
Why are they more a problem?
No, why aren't they more popular?
I need time to think about that. I've never even thought of them. It's low density gas.
No, like helium or something, you know, very light, so there's less air load.
Look, it has a leakage issue. Low density gas tends to go through membranes very quickly, so it goes away and it probably deteriorates in time, all other things being.
If you had a metal can, say, and you managed to get the surround correct, gas tight.
Well, one of the things to remember is that we're terribly dependent on the state of technology in building things. You know, that's your answer. I must say, I've never thought of it, so this is why I say, But that's the sort of thing that I think leakage and same thing of retaining the stuff behind.
Replacing?
Well, so long as it's not hydrogen. Not a satisfactory answer, I must say. But yes. Now you better let me come to you.
Okay. Halfway. I wondered about very, very small loudspeakers, such as used in cell phones and things, where it looks like. I wondered if you felt there were any differences, or do you feel that these principles apply exactly the same? If the diaphragm is non-linear, or somehow a bit more wavy.
In general, they aim to be the same, and of course they've got the same problems that you've always got troubles with non-linearity, in particular. This of course, I'm coming out here, so I'm facing the audience. The troubles that we have with existing speakers is all that stuff has to do with the low frequency parameters. And that really only, if you say low frequency parameters, it sounds as though we're only dealing with frequencies below 400 hertz. In fact, it applies to tweeters, of course, at frequencies up to about 5 or 6,000 hertz. But none of this has anything to do with breakup. And there's a whole world out there of people trying to get to make cones that are stiff enough and still don't make wiggles. If you've seen, there's marvellous work done by Wolfgang Trippel. I don't know if you've seen that marvellous stuff that he's done. And the other thing that I've seen in China, I've been into a room that must be twice as wide and three times as long as this room, I think. And what was displayed in it? Nothing but different types of cone material. Wool and goodness knows what. And there are people trying to get the ideal cone. It's, the
dear old GEC metal cone of about 1952 or so was just aluminium with dimples pressed in to stiffen it. But all of them, when you talk to Volkswagen and Klipper, you wonder why we ever try anyway. And of course, and that leads on to the part that I didn't go on to. That's one of the reasons why we go to two ways, because that the sort of trouble in a low frequency speaker starts to occur around about 500 or so. So you quick go to a smaller one that you're in the non-wiggle, I call it, range.
Breakup.
Yes, or what's called breakup. Yeah.
Is there any link or is there any problem because of the shorter wavelength? If you're thinking, in my mind, I'm thinking of a speaker that that might be in the earpiece for your cell phone or your telephone. If the wavelength is very short, if the speaker then is if we're thinking of frequencies where the box is
for about 660 hertz, and we're not. By that time, we're not depending on the box at all.
No.
So, okay. Of course, there are wheels within wheels. There's a lovely thing that appeared in the British Journal of Wireless World. Go back here. Yep. Around about in the 1960s, there was a piece. I've already forgotten what I was going. What he said was a science with more than seven variables is an art, and that is a definition. That is why loudspeaker design is an art. You can't have a perfect loudspeaker because you're always working within a different set of user requirements. I mean, somebody might want a lot of power. Somebody might want a beautiful flat frequency response. And somebody might want it cheaper. And you've got all these different dimensions. And I assure you that the number go above seven. And that's what makes it exciting to work in.
So. Neville, I'm conscious of the... Oh, sorry, Peter, one last question. Okay.
And I will come up close to make sure I hear you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that presentation. I wondered, do you have an opinion on the audible difference between a fourth order alignment or a second order alignment with the same cutoff frequency? And if you were trying to design a speaker to get good reviews in the hi-fi mags that want a tight bass,
yes,
would you put more down, make the response more damped than a Butterworth?
That is a... Oh, right. Well, you all want to hear. That's a question that I get asked at least every year by students. And really, that comes down to if you have a sharp cutoff of a filter, whether it's high frequency or low frequency, you will get great peaks of group delay. Now, first of all, there's no reliable figures on that I know of, anyway, on low-frequency group delay. You know, I have students that come along and say, look, I think you're wasting your time talking to us about vented boxes because they give a fourth-order response, and that always gives group delay error. And then there's JBL who like to go for a Bessel roll-off, which is a linear phase... delay. I don't know what the figures are, but there's one thing, and I haven't got it just as well. I haven't got a slide for it here. One of the interesting things is, if you don't mind my drawing pictures in the air. Wait a minute. Which way? The way you're looking. Yeah. We go low frequency here, high frequency here. When you get the response. The higher order you go to, as you were not guessing, as you were virtually saying, if you go to a higher order, you will get a greater peak of group delay. And you look at it and say, that's appalling. For I think it's a sixth order Butterworth, cutting off at 20 hertz, you can get a group delay error of 60 milliseconds. And as somebody said, I don't care what you say, but you're not being able to hear group delay too well. But if your high frequencies arrive today and your low frequencies arrive tomorrow, you've really got distortion. And but that said, the interesting thing is that if you compare a cutoff at 20 hertz with a cutoff at 40 hertz, you get obviously the same shaped curves. But the interesting thing is that the curve group delay goes for the low frequency one, which has had this great big peak, is down below the 40 hertz one at frequencies beyond the geometric mean, below 28 hertz. So you've got this great enormous 60 millisecond thing, and it goes down, and most of them, by the time you get to 100 hertz, I've never tried to be on sixth order, but you're down below a millisecond group delay. And the figures for mid-frequencies are that and again, I'm wary about quoting this, but the figures of 3 milliseconds are quite acceptable. But there's no work done that I know, and there's also the problem that the only way to measure group delay reliably is to measure it, you measure group delay rather than phase delay. Now, to measure group delay, you've got to modulate the signal that you've got with a lower frequency. So if you're going down to 20 hertz, you really need to have a modulating frequency of 5 hertz. And nobody makes equipment that does it. You'd have to roll your own to do it. The Vondel and Goltermann make it for telecommunications, but they only go down to 300 hertz. So that's... I'm dressing up a non-answer in very, very good scientific term, but the answer is I really don't know.
Now, I want to give people the chance to come up and introduce themselves and say hello, so we'll call an end to it then.
Already.
Yeah, of course. I want to say a particular thanks, because I'm very aware that this may be your last visit to London. So thank you very much for taking the time to come and talk to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.